This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Last Girl Gone, a Laura Chambers mystery by J.G. Heatherton. This book is read by Laura Jennings. To my wife, Alice, this book couldn't exist without you, and neither could I. Prologue. If there was an art to running away, Patty Finch didn't know it. Twice before she had tried to escape, and twice before she had been caught and returned. This third try, she promised herself, would be different. This third time would be the charm. After this, her mother would never see her again. She would be gone forever. She would simply disappear. About that much, at least, Patty Finch was right. Spectators clogged the path connecting the parking lot and gate. She moved along with them, in no rush, studying the crowd. The biggest category comprised single young men, hats perched on the backs of their heads, sweat staining their underarms and backs. Even close to sunset, the day's heat gnawed at them. Every few steps they paused to peel cloth from flesh. Less common were the families, fathers with sons upon their shoulders, harried women pushing their daughters along, trying not to lose them in the growing flow of race vans. It was a valid concern. Patty had never seen so many people in one place. Certainly, she thought, it was more people than lived in all of Hillsboro combined. Folks had come from nearby towns, drawn by the annual exhibition race on an original dirt NASCAR track, excited to see the speed and hear the roar. And they were just a little bit bloodthirsty, secretly hoping for a crash. In 1986, just 2 years before, Bobby Allison had set a course record and three men had slid cars into the river trying to catch him. Tonight, Bobby was back, the best entertainment in 50 miles. Patty wove through a group of young men slapping each other's backs and singing a Navy song, headed toward a likely-looking family. The father had two young children gripped tightly around the wrists, and behind him, the mother was carrying a baby. Bringing up the rear was Dot Camlett, high-stepping to keep her penny loafers clean and fussing at the bow tied in her hair. She was skinny as a stick, with an unfortunately shaped nose and not too many friends because of it. The ideal candidate. Hiya, Dot. Dot examined her for a second, trying to place her. Patty took no offense at this. The Finches hadn't been in town more than a couple of months, plus Dot was in a different class. Then she had it. Maggie Finch? Patty, she corrected. Sorry. Patty fell into step next to her and glanced up ahead. Neither Mr. nor Mrs. Camlett seemed to have noticed. You like Mrs. Hall's class? Dot asked, still tugging at the bow strangling her hair. Patty shrugged. It's all right, I guess. In front of them, the crowd split itself between corrugated metal walls. Dot's father started down the middle of the three chutes, approaching the ticket taker and handing him a thin stack of paper. The ticket taker spoke, and Mr. Camlett turned and looked back. Patty pinned her eyes to the dirt and tried to appear insignificant. Just another child in the crowd. Mr. Camlett gestured backward toward his family. The ticket taker nodded, and then they were moving forward again. Patty slipped an arm around Dot's elbow, put on her friendliest face, and said, "Gee, aren't you excited to see the races?" Dot, it turned out, was very excited to see the races, particularly the handsome and daring drivers. She blathered on as they slipped through the gate behind Dot's mother. No one stopped them. Patty breathed a sigh of relief. 20 yards past the entrance, she cut Dot off. "Gotta go find my mother. See ya, Dot." Dot gave her a hangdog look, her prospects for friendship once again slim. "Sure, if you say so." Patty almost felt bad for her. "But let's keep talking later," she said, and Dot perked back up and gave her a smile. Patty turned and disappeared into the crowd, feeling pretty good about herself. After all, what harm could the promise do? She wouldn't have to break it exactly. No, she'd be gone long before it could become an issue. The path ended at the top of the stands, big poured concrete steps set into the hillside. Below them curved the first turn. The track was packed brown dirt, and it had a slight inward tilt, the result of bulldozers building up a berm around the outside. Behind turns 2 and 3, the Eno River glinted in the fading light. The whole track was fitted into a bend in the river, the area naturally flat as a result. Patty counted the rubberneckers filling the stands. The number grew and grew, the size of the crowd delighting her. What an immense mass of people to never see again. Her heart fluttered. She knew, felt it in her bones, that where her other schemes had failed, this one would succeed. Practice, after all, makes perfect. The first time she ran away, her mistake had been inviting Janet Fontaine. Janet was afraid of her own shadow. Patty knew that. Hell, everybody knew that. But it had been a calculated risk. Janet's parents were rich enough to own a 5-bedroom house on Queen Street. They had a woman who lived in the old converted woodshed and washed and cleaned for them. They had a basement the size of a swimming pool and a larder that took up nearly half that space. Janet would have been a joke out there on the road, nothing but dead weight. But Patty aimed to get at least a few cans of peaches out of her traveling companion before ultimately ditching her. It hadn't worked out that way. Janet lost her nerve, told at the first opportunity, and a policeman in a shiny black and white Ford interrupted Patty's march to the interstate. He turned her around, walked her home, and delivered her right back to her mother. Mildred Finch answered the door with tears in her eyes, hugged the policeman, thanked him again and again, and made him promise to come over one night for a home-cooked meal. He doffed his hat, said he'd make it if he could. Then he was gone, and her mother stopped pretending. "You little monster," had been the first words out of her mouth, followed by a swift backhand that knocked Patty down to the rough floorboards. "Mama, don't." "No backtalk. That's no way for a little girl to behave, is it?" Patty shook her head, pain shooting up her neck. Mildred Finch made a fist, knelt, then buried it in Patty's stomach. Mildred liked to hit. She was good at it, and she liked it. And in her experience, such a combination was one of life's rare treasures. "No, what?"
"No, ma'am,"
Patty said, air slipping out fast between her gapped teeth like a snake's hiss. The starburst of pain in her gut making it difficult to breathe. "That's better, little one," Mildred said, and launched into her usual lecture about the evils of the world. As always, the chief danger listed was Patty's father. They had been running away from him for 2 years, hiding themselves in various small towns dotted across the North Carolina countryside. Even at 10 years old, Patty had a sense of the strange resonance between their original escape and her own current desire to vanish. Her mother had run away and deemed it justice. Patty ran away, and her mother labeled it a betrayal. Mildred worked herself up into the usual frenzy, pacing back and forth, gesticulating wildly with her hands. Patty twitched each time one of the hands came nearer. "He was no good trash, Patty. He pushed that rotten pecker into anyone who would take it. And who would take it? Who would let a man like that slide his slimy little worm into them?" Patty knew the answer to this and gave the response her mother expected to hear. "Horse, ma'am?" "That's right, little girl. If you want to get by in this world, if you want to see it true, that's all you really need to know. Men are bastards, and any woman who would let them have their way, who would open her legs, is a whore. Isn't that right?" It wasn't a question. She nodded and tuned out as her mother charged ahead. It was a speech Patty had heard 1,000 times before. Even then, she was scheming her next attempt. The second time she ran away, 1 month after the first, no one knew her plan. The lesson of the first try had been very clear. Tell no one, and no one can tell on you. She kept to the alley behind the main street, Churden, and worked her way down to the intersection of Churden and King. A right on King would lead past the 2- and 3-story brick buildings downtown, and then up into the rich neighborhoods filled with big houses. Straight ahead, the road carried over a bridge spanning the Eno River and then dropped into the river's floodplain, running 1.5 miles past antique stores and fast food restaurants. It ended at the interstate. Patty headed straight and made her way across the bridge. 50 yards past it, parked in a turnout, was the black and white Ford. Not again. A policeman, the same one as before, climbed out and walked over to her. He took off his hat before taking a knee. His hair shone blonde in the sunlight, and it was thin enough that she could see his scalp. "Patty Finch?" he asked. This meeting had been no accident. "Yes?" The air slipped out between her teeth, the same as when she'd been punched.
"The station got a call from your mama. I guess she saw you tying up that rucksack."
He pointed to her bag.
"And put two and two together."
Patty said nothing, just kicked at the dirt with the toe of her shoe.
"You know," he said, "packing like that makes it pretty clear what you're doing, don't you think?"
He was right, of course. All the pieces came together then, and she knew exactly what had happened. Her mother had seen the missing clothes, or caught a glimpse of her stuffing them under her bed, and had divined everything about her plan. How could she have been so obvious, so foolish? She waited meekly for the policeman to smack her and call her stupid. But he didn't do that.
"Maybe we could take a little ride in my car and talk about why you're running away. What do you think?"
Patty wasn't used to being asked what she thought. She looked up from the ground, surprised. With him kneeling, his eyes weren't more than 8 or 10 inches up, and liquid brown. They had crinkle lines at the edges that made him look like he was smiling, even when he wasn't. She nodded and got into the car with him, into the passenger seat and not the back like a criminal. She let him drive her up and down the streets. He did most of the talking. His name was Donald Rogers. He was originally from Yanceyville, up near the Virginia border. He had been a police officer for about 2 years. He liked it just fine, thank you. The police car came to a stop. Patty realized they were sitting outside her house. Her shoulders hunched forward, and she slumped down into the seat, watching carefully for any sign of movement at the front window.
"Tell me true, Patty. You scared of going back in there?"
Her head spun around, and she looked into those big brown eyes and imagined for a second he would be able to save her. She nodded.
"I had a pa who I couldn't wait to get away from,"
Don Rogers said.
"Used to beat me something fierce. And when he was too drunk to aim his punches, he'd just swing wild with his belt, like it was a whip."
He paused, and they sat in the silence for a while.
"I'll see what I can do to help," he said after a bit.
She nodded again and climbed out of the car. He drove away from her slowly, and she sensed some reluctance in it. Could reluctance be detected in the way a car drove? She believed it could. She waited for him to turn the corner before going inside to face the music. Sitting on the concrete steps above the racetrack, replaying the scene in her mind, she had the overwhelming urge to reach out and slap herself. "He can't help you, girl. He won't do a thing for you," she wanted to shriek. Instead, Patty shook the memory away, turned and spit on the ground. It had been stupid to think Deputy Rogers could do anything at all, but it was no use ruminating on past mistakes. The cars stacked up at the starting line and fired their engines. The throaty roar lifted up through the pine trees and carried away on the wind. When the race was over, Patty made her way to the parking lot. This was the crux of her plan, to find a woman, an out-of-towner, and convince her she needed a ride to somewhere like Raleigh or Greensboro. Either way, she would have a 40-mile head start. That was all she needed. Yellow sodium lamps stood in a long line down the center of the lot, hissing and painting the passing crowd in sickly shades of yellow. Mosquitoes hovered in black knots near their glow, occasionally breaking off to dive the spectators in crazed kamikaze runs. The people hurried to their cars. The plan was working poorly. Patty found it difficult to approach the families as they slid past, and the few times she managed to speak up, they brushed her aside like a panhandler begging for change. In minutes, half the lot was empty, the aisles clogged with big curved Fords and Chevys angling toward the exit. Headlights slashed tunnels through the mist rolling in off the river. The lamps sputtered once and then went out. She walked toward the back of the lot and sat down on a stump. Only a few cars were left,
and these she suspected might belong to the workers at the track. All of them were sure to be local. The third attempt had failed like all the others. Stupid, she thought, and punched herself on the thigh. Directly behind her, an engine turned over once, and twin headlights reached out through the fog, landing on the stump like spotlights. She turned and looked over her shoulder, squinting into the glare. A car door opened. Boots crunched on the gravel.
Hey there, a voice called.
Patty raised a hand and tried to shield her eyes. She couldn't see anything more than the shape of wide shoulders and the outline of a hat hovering above them.
You out here all alone?
It was a man's voice, raspy, like he'd been punched in the throat. I'm just waiting, she said and stopped. All that preparation and the question still caught her off guard. She tried to cobble together her story, tried to think of the best way to play it. Was he local? The voice wasn't familiar.
Waiting for who, sweetheart?
She said nothing.
Waiting for your boyfriend?
Patty Finch was 10 years old. She had never even held a boy's hand. I don't have a boyfriend, she volunteered.
That's too bad, he said. That's not right.
A click and the car's lights were gone. But her night vision was ruined. She saw nothing but blackness, heard a rustle and the click of a lighter. For a second, she could make out a sharp chin and the end of a hooked nose. But the rest of the man's face remained hidden behind his hat as he craned his neck down toward the flame. Then the lighter went out, and he was gone again. The red cherry of his cigarette floated in space, rhythmically glowing and fading, pulsing like the tides. It was Patty who broke the silence. I gotta get home, she said.
Thought you were waiting for a ride.
I gotta get home, she repeated and took a step backward.
Hey, don't I know you?
No, she said.
Sure I do.
He threw down the smoke and ground it under his heel, and the darkness was complete again.
You're Patty Finch, aren't you?
She stopped moving and tried to think of a man who knew the Finch family. Couldn't come up with anyone. There was the principal, Mr. Lugol, and Deputy Rogers who had given her a ride home. But this man wasn't either of them. Then who? Someone who knew her mother? It was as if he could read her mind.
Does your mama know you're out here all alone?
At the mention of her mother, Patty looked down and started toeing the dirt with one shoe.
Does she?
He asked again. This time there was an edge in his voice. No, sir, she said.
Well, you shouldn't be. It's not safe to be out here alone at night, a little girl like you. There are dangerous men in the world.
Patty had heard this speech before. It was all her mother ever talked about. Yes, sir, she said.
Now get in the car. I'm taking you home.
She hesitated.
Patty Finch, you get in this car. You get in this car right now, and maybe I won't tell your mama where I found you.
She looked up, eyes searching the dark space that housed the voice. A bit of hope straightened her shoulders. You promise, mister? You promise you won't tell?
I won't tell if you won't, Patty.
And then he laughed. The laugh surprised her. It was an octave higher than his voice, and it had a musical quality, almost girlish. She liked the sound of it. Hearing his laugh made the decision much easier. Besides, what other choice did she have? The car seat was smooth brown leather, redolent of whiskey and smoke and some kind of perfume. She sank deep into it, and she still couldn't make out his face in the darkness. Do you have to take me home right away? She asked. He weighed this, as though considering doing her a favor.
If you want, he said finally. I could take you somewhere else.
She nodded happily, and he started the engine. Part 1. Small Town Blues. Girl's body found. Police continue search for second missing child. By Laura Chambers. July 7th, 2017. Hillsboro, North Carolina. Tragedy struck early Thursday morning when the body of a young girl was discovered in a soybean field 4 miles east of Hillsboro, North Carolina.
The deceased has been identified as Olive Hansen. Hansen, age 10, was reported missing the night of July 4th, and a police search has been underway since the early morning hours of July 5th. That search came to an end at approximately 7:30 a.m. yesterday morning when her body was discovered by a local farmer. Police have been closed-mouthed about details of the case, refusing to either confirm or deny that Hansen's death was the result of foul play. In a statement put out Thursday afternoon, the Orange County Sheriff's Office confirmed the victim's identity and described the investigation as ongoing. A second child, with Hansen at the time of her disappearance, remains missing. Teresa Mitchum, also age 10, was last seen in the company of the victim on the night of July 4th. Asked about the status of the search for Mitchum, Sheriff Walter McKinney reiterated the department's policy not to discuss investigations in progress. According to a missing persons report filed jointly by the Hansen and Mitchum families the morning of July 5th, both girls asked permission to visit the other with plans to set off fireworks. The ruse was discovered when Angie Mitchum, the missing girl's mother, arrived unannounced at the Hansen residence looking for her daughter. Neither family has been willing to comment. "They were good girls, both of them," said a neighbor, Leanne Cooks. "Always together. They didn't have a mean bone in their bodies. Who would do this?" That attitude of disbelief was echoed on the streets of downtown Thursday night. Citizens gathered in front of the Orange County Courthouse and formed an impromptu vigil, burning candles and singing hymns. Among the mourners was Hillsborough Mayor Craig Smythe. "I have been assured by Sheriff McKinney that he and the fine deputies of the OCSO are doing everything in their power to locate Teresa Mitchum and to bring her home safely," he said. "At this point, there's nothing to do but pray." Anyone with details about the case was asked to call the Orange County Sheriff's Department at 555-890-3600. Chapter 1. Laura reread the article for the third time and grimaced at the last line. "Nothing to do but pray." Tell that to the Hansen family. She could picture them in a back room of the mortuary, slumped on pieces of cheap office furniture, flipping through a coffin catalog, faces gray as wet cardboard. Would the mayor have the courage, nay, the faith, to look them in the eye and say it again? She doubted it. Her eyes drifted until they landed again on her name at the top of the article. Laura Chambers. She dragged a fingernail over the letters, scoring a thin line across their middle. Something about physical contact made them more real. Though she was ashamed to admit it, Laura never tired of seeing her name in print. She started reading the article for a fourth time before crumpling the paper into a ball and shoving it in the trash. Her favorite journalism professor, Murray Popovich, had talked endlessly about the thrill of millions of people seeing those little letters printed at the top of a front-page story. He called it the vanity of the byline. Murray likened it to a siren's call, praising its motive force, while warning his students not to crash their ships onto the rocks. "Seeing your name in print is beautiful and dangerous," he said. Murray always talked like that, in complete poetic sentences. The short, goateed little man had entranced her from the very first class. She'd always understood the concept of journalism as a force for good, but Murray was the one who made her believe it. Laura shook off the memory and made a mental note not to revisit it. It offered nothing but pain. Murray was dead. She was trapped in a podunk town in North Carolina, and her only consolation was that her mentor had died in time to avoid witnessing her disgrace. Nervous energy buzzed in her chest. She forced herself to stand and pace the length of her so-called office. It had been a selling point of the job during her phone interview with Bass Herman, editor-in-chief of the Hillsborough Gazette. "You'll love it," he'd said. "It's cozy, plenty of character." Only later had she recognized his pitch as copy torn from a real estate advertisement, the kind used to sell thin, ugly houses no one wanted to buy. An honest ad would have read something like, "Stinky hot box, no views, partially air-conditioned, available immediately, lots of privacy, no one in their right mind would spend time here." Beautiful it wasn't. Unpainted cinder block passed for walls. The only window sat 8 feet off the ground, a lucite slit designed to admit the minimum of light. Two doors and the top of a staircase separated the space from the main newsroom, but no one used the staircase. The door at the bottom was exit only, without an exterior handle. It all added up to a concrete closet at the end of Forever, a place the other staffers rarely visited and never lingered, which made the squeak of her office door all the more surprising. "Morning, Colin," she said, and gave him one of her best smiles, trying to keep the edge of disgust out of her voice. Colin Smythe was the child of Mayor Craig Smythe, but acted like he was the firstborn son of a king. 2 months ago, preparing for her first day at the Gazette, Laura had read every back issue dating to the first of the year. Smythe, whose articles appeared at least 3 times a week, had managed to make her blood curdle long before they ever met. His worldview combined the moral compass of Christopher Columbus with the keen human insight of a bowl of clam chowder. Blacks, women, the poor. If they were down, Colin Smythe's philosophy was, put a boot on their throat and keep them that way.
"You look beautiful this morning, Laura."
He spoke in a light country accent. He didn't wink, not that it mattered. A wink from Colin would be the definition of redundant. There were ballistic missiles with more subtlety. He wore a shapeless linen blazer over a crewneck t-shirt, the color of fresh blood. One hand held a rolled-up copy of the Gazette. She edged back around the corner of her desk and perched on her chair. "I don't think I've ever seen you in my office."
"You never made the front page before.
We've got the morning editorial meeting in a few, so I thought we could chat." "I've had plenty of front page stories," she said. He leaned against the wall.
"Sure, in Boston, right?"
His eyes fastened on hers, waiting for a reaction. Laura ordered herself not to take the bait. "Yes, in Boston," she said.
"But not here."
"No, not until this morning." He winced, and Laura almost smiled.
"How's the job treating you? You like it?"
Now he was acting like her boss. She gritted her teeth. "Bass and I meet every week about my progress here."
"What did you say to him in there anyway? How'd you get the big man to bump this story to the front page?"
"I didn't get him to do anything. All I did was write it up and drop it on his desk. What else was he going to put on the front page? Your review of the local theater production of Fiddler on the Roof?"
Laura shuffled together her papers and butted the edges until they were flush. "It's news, Colin. Not that this town gets much."
He came off the wall and placed 2 T-bone-sized hands flat on her desk.
"Don't start telling me about this town."
"I was born here."
"And abandoned ship the first chance you got. This story is a ticket to the big time."
She narrowed her eyes.
"Don't give me that look, like it's a betrayal to even say it out loud. No one gets on the Globe's front page without climbing across the bodies of a few fallen comrades." "I don't know you that well, Laura, but then again, I don't need to. That's just the way of the world."
Laura checked her watch.
"And don't pretend you've got somewhere important to be. I write features."
He jerked a thumb toward his chest.
"And you're on cleanup duty."
"My cleaning up not good enough?" she asked.
He smirked. "Not nearly. You'll have to learn to scrub up a bit better if you ever want to find a husband in this town."
"Are you done?"
"Not even close. Missing girl turns up dead. Not drowned by accident in the Eno, or killed by her drunken daddy, but taken by some stranger and then left in that field for us to find. I've never heard of something like that. It may happen in other parts of the country, but not here. Major papers will want a piece of what's going on here. This story is a ticket out, and I'm taking it."
Laura stood, came around the desk. "Here's a bit of advice. When you talk about a little girl's death, try not to look so damned excited." He flushed, then raised the hand holding the rolled-up newspaper toward her face. She turned her head, ready for him to hit her. The paper stopped an inch from her face, and he smiled at her wince. 15 years into adulthood, and still the schoolyard bully.
"How'd you get that story anyway?"
His voice came out so quiet it was nearly a whisper.
"One second someone finds the body, the next you've already gotten the story typed up and turned in. If I didn't know better, I'd say you killed her."
He moved closer until they were nose to nose. She could see the white spittle collected at the corner of his mouth and smell the onions on his breath.
No, I know what happened, he continued. Your boyfriend called you, didn't he? Soon as the sheriff looked away, Deputy Stewart dropped a dime and fed you every last thing you needed. Was that how you climbed the ladder in Boston? On your back? The raw, unconcealed hatred radiating outward from him shocked her. She took a big step back, then tried to take another one, but there was nowhere to go. Her back was pressed against the wall. Laura had been a consumer of therapy since first escaping Hillsborough at the age of 18. Situations like this, her first therapist would have said, offer three options. Be neutral, escalate, or de-escalate. De-escalation was what most people would call taking the high road. Her therapist had encouraged her to take the high road whenever possible, and probably it was the best decision here, too. She'd have to work with Smythe for the foreseeable future. Calm down, she told herself. Just play nice. But she couldn't do it. It was his face, cheekbones that could plain oak, thin, bloodless lips pressed together and turned up at the corner in contempt. An Aryan's wet dream. She despised that face. Neutrality was the best she could manage. Arms crossed in front of her. She exhaled sharply, flecks of saliva landing on his chin. He ran a hand down his face and crumpled the paper, then dropped it into the waste paper basket. Anyway, he said, his voice back to its normal, unhurried gait. Just wanted to give you a heads up. As the more experienced staffer, I'm getting Bass to hand the reins over to me. You got a problem with that? Laura shrugged. Anything she said would serve only to burn bridges. His smile beamed so bright you'd have thought she'd just bent over and kissed his toes. Didn't think so, he said. One loud squeak of the rusty hinges and he was gone. Laura gave him a minute, then opened the door herself. She crossed the top landing of the steps and emerged in the small hallway at the back of the newsroom, then ducked into the ladies' room. Old habits die hard. The daily editorial meeting at the Boston Globe had been a crowded affair held in a boardroom with the table and chairs removed to make room for all the staffers and assistants. The object of meetings, Laura believed, was to stand out. She hadn't fussed over her appearance since showing up in Hillsborough 2 months ago, but Smythe's arrogance had fired something raw and angry in her belly. Now it was time to be ready. She took a breath and examined herself in the mirror, running a finger through the dark ringlets of hair that fell to her shoulders, unwinding the kinks. The dress code at the Gazette was decidedly more casual than at the Globe. She wore dark purple jeans, Converse All-Stars, and a denim jacket over a black t-shirt emblazoned with the white silhouette of Frank Sinatra. Gold hoop earrings, thin enough to be tasteful, stood out against her light olive skin. Somewhere in her family tree, there must have been a relative from Italy. An eighth-inch gap showed between her two front teeth, the source of much torment during her middle school years. These days, she had bigger problems. The eyes, she told herself, betrayed a wisdom far beyond her 29 years. The most difficult thing about her encounter with Colin Smythe had been the little voice inside her screaming, "He's right. He knows." Even as she pretended disgust at his blatant opportunism, she had been planning her next move. Because he was right. This story, told correctly, had the potential to lift its author up and carry them away to bigger and better things. There was only one ticket, and it belonged to the person whose name was printed under the headline. She ran another finger through her hair and made herself a promise. It would be her name at the top of the page, no matter what. Chapter 2.
Everyone shut up, Bass Herman waved a hand at the group, gesturing for them to be seated. He had a gut the size of an aircraft carrier, and he navigated like one too, pointing his stomach in the direction he wanted to go, and dragging the rest of his body along behind it. Usually, people got out of the way. He wore a British banker's shirt in salmon, the white collar damp with sweat, suspenders and cheap slip-on loafers. His hair looked like whitewater, and his hands were stained yellow by years of nicotine use. He pointed a discolored finger at Smythe.
What exactly are we planning for Sunday's feature? Not this solstice festival shit again.
Smythe coughed into his fist.
Well, my series on local celebrations, Bass cut him off. Forget it.
The only thing this town hates more than Jews is pagans.
The solstice isn't pagan per se, Smythe said.
Who cares? People think it's devil worship. These are good Christian people, Mr. Smythe, and their preferred brand of Christianity is loud and proud. None of this love thy neighbor, no hate, believe what you want, hippy-dippy bullshit. These people are Old Testament connoisseurs.
Bass smacked a yellow hand down onto the table.
They're Baptists, goddammit.
Laura knew her office was bad, but the conference room would bring a tenured government worker to tears. It had no windows and few lamps. Piles of paper and other trash leaned into every corner. Moldy ceiling tiles threatened to collapse at any moment. Inexplicably, Bass Herman liked to use the conference room as part of his office.
Yes, sir, Smythe said.
After just 2 months, even Laura knew enough to sit down and shut up once Bass Herman started yelling.
He's right, you know.
A nasal voice perked up from the back. Laura twisted in her chair, trying to see who had the guts to speak up.
Natalie something or other, the mousy administrative assistant, stood behind Smythe, one hand holding a notepad and the other on his shoulder.
Herman pressed several of his chins into his chest and looked down his nose at her.
Excuse me?
I was saying,
Herman cut her off.
You writing articles now?
Me?
She clasped her hands in front of her chest, the notebook pressed between them, face open in genuine surprise.
Maybe you've been scooping the Gazette under some nom de plume, working nights, weekends.
Nom de plume?
She repeated. Even for a North Carolina native, her French accent was terrible. Smythe reached up and brushed her hand off his shoulder. He spoke between his teeth.
Sit down and stop talking, Natalie. You're making me look like an idiot.
The light in the girl's eyes died. She hung her head and sat back in her seat against the wall. Notepad at the ready. Her expression reminded Laura of a dog whose beloved master had just kicked it in the ribs.
Okay, enough, Herman said. You have your assignments. No missed deadlines. Miss Chambers, stay back for a moment.
Everyone else stood and filed out. It gave Laura time to plan out exactly what she wanted to say.
Ms. Chambers.
He pronounced it the Southern way, as though it ended in a Z.
Ms. Chambers. Congratulations on your first front-page story for the Gazette. When I hired you, it was because I knew you could produce great journalism here.
Thank you, she said.
You're welcome. Now that we have the compliments necessary to massage your journalist's ego out of the way, let's move on to the bad news.
Laura already had a pretty good idea of what was coming. He put his hands in his pockets and closed his eyes.
I'm considering handing the story off to Colin Smythe.
You're not happy with my coverage.
She didn't phrase it as a question. Not at all. You seem to have excellent sources. It's clear you're used to a fast-paced competitive environment. Hillsborough isn't Boston, but it's nice to get a little hustle. Mr. Smythe met with me this morning.
He's campaigning for the story?
I wouldn't put it quite like that, but he also made some good points.
Such as?
Such as his local contacts. Certainly you have a few yourself. You couldn't have gotten the story so fast without being persuasive.
So I'll match him contact for contact. Let me write the story, Bass. Using his first name seemed to startle him. His eyes flicked open.
There's no comparison, Ms. Chambers.
His drawl landed even harder on the formal miss, stretching it out.
You've been here 2 months. I know, you grew up here. But you also left a long time ago. People have opened up to Colin before. With you, I'm not so sure.
So you're saying people won't talk to me because I got too big for my britches and left Hillsborough? Her hands clenched into fists, as though me leaving for something better draws attention to anything here that's worse.
That sentiment exists in certain circles, yes.
So let me take a shot at it, Laura said. If you're not happy, make the switch. He nodded.
My thoughts exactly. I need something for Sunday's edition.
That's in 2 days.
Which gives you until tomorrow at deadline.
There's no way I can. He raised a hand, cutting her off.
I need something for Sunday's edition. It has to be good, too. No rehashing of old news. This story will probably get picked up in Raleigh, Atlanta. Who knows?
Laura took a deep breath. Okay.
Good girl. That's why I hired you.
I know you took a chance with that, Mr. Herman. He levered himself down into the room's single chair, leaned back, and laced his fingers over his belly.
We've all made mistakes, Ms. Chambers.
Even you? He allowed himself a rare smile.
Even me, in my youth.
During my interview, you asked about what happened in Boston. He waited expectantly, his face serene. And I confirmed it happened just like the Globe told you.
Hmm, Herman said. Parted ways. That was their euphemism of choice.
But you never asked me anything else about it.
Your memory is correct.
Why not?
Well, that's an interesting question. I could tell you I'm not a nosy person by nature, but who could believe that, me being the editor-in-chief of a local rag? All we do is nose our way into other people's business. I guess maybe it's because I know what shame looks like.
I don't understand. He pointed out into the newsroom, a space 3 or 4 times the size of the conference room, with desks pushed together in groups of 2.
I see you walking. No, make that skulking around out there. Head down, barely meeting anyone's eye. Hell, you never look at me. You seem to think you sold me a bill of goods, young lady. That you tricked me into buying something damaged and got away with it.
She examined a ceiling tile. Didn't I?
Hardly. Put it behind you, Ms. Chambers.
That doesn't answer anything. Why hire me? Herman tapped a copy of the day's paper lying on the table.
Pure self-interest. You've got good instincts. Truth is, if you'd never screwed up, we never could have gotten a reporter of your caliber on staff.
You think I'm worth the risk? Bass Herman nodded his all-knowing nod.
Ms. Chambers, I consider you a bargain.
Chapter 3. Did you feel threatened? It was a newspaper, not a knife. Still, in the adult world, we rarely expect to be confronted with any type of physical violence. It doesn't take a lethal weapon. If someone shoved you or spit on you, wouldn't you feel threatened then? If someone spit on me, I'd feel pissed off. But you're not pissed off now. Like hell I'm not. They sat across from each other in overstuffed armchairs, Laura's with a matching ottoman. Opposite her, Dr. Jasmine Devane sat perched on the edge of her seat, legs crossed, absent-mindedly twirling a pin. During their first session a month ago, Laura had asked the obvious question. What, no couch? Dr. Devane had shaken her head. Too much temptation. Laura assumed she was referring to some dark corner of her patients' minds, a negative sexual behavior triggered in the presence of a couch, and Dr. Devane had seen the look on her face. No, no, it's not what you're thinking. The temptation is all mine. I used to have one, but I ended up taking too many naps. It was right then, right at the beginning, when she'd noticed just how funny Dr. Devane could be. She played the part of the professional well, always in low heels, trousers, and earth-toned tops. Her dark hair had a strain of muted red running through it, and she tended to pull it back in a loose chignon. Because of the polished facade, it was easy to overlook her sense of humor. Most therapists took their work and themselves very seriously. Laura had patronized a number of them over the years, and she'd laughed in all her combined therapy sessions about as often as while learning about Nazi Germany. But Dr. Devane had a light touch, even when she was poking a sore spot. Do you think he had the will to do you physical harm? I think he wanted to, yes. But those aren't the same thing, Dr. Devane said. We all want to do harm at one time or another, even if it's just fantasy. For most of us, it stops there. Our own little theater of the mind playing out revenge on, say, high school bullies or the dry cleaner who ruined our favorite shirt. Fantasies like that are normal, even healthy in small doses. He wanted to hurt me, Laura said. He had the desire. How do you know? Laura shrugged. Just a gut feeling. There was something in his eyes. Still, that's only half the equation. Plenty of people want to do things. An extra ingredient is necessary to separate fantasy from reality. Will, people who cross the line into actual physical violence need that little something extra. This was real. He was there, in the room, staring right through me with those dead eyes of his. Isn't that more than fantasy?
Of course.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Whether you perceived it as a threat or not, the kind of person who could do what he did, it suggests the capacity for more.
So what now? I can't tell you that, Laura, but I can tell you to be careful around this one.
Sometimes the doctor's gaze could be a little too penetrating. It gave her the willies on a knot in her stomach, the same one she got from dreams about being naked in front of her sixth grade class. Laura looked away, pretended to glance around the office, even though she remembered every inch. It was a block off Churton Street, Hillsborough's main thoroughfare, in a one-time warehouse split into office suites. Gauzy floor-to-ceiling curtains admitted plenty of soft, natural light, exposed brick walls, Asian-inspired decor. Oriental rugs adorned the floors and the walls, sucking up even the smallest sounds. There were no echoes. It felt like talking in a box full of cotton balls, which was effective, she had to admit. There was security in knowing that no one could hear them, and no sound from the outside world made it in. A room walled off from the world, like a castle with a moat. Safe. Best of all, the thermostat was set to 68 degrees. Can we back up for a second? Laura turned her focus back to the doctor. To where? Well, you finished the story about your colleague. She said the word with a forced professionalism, almost as if she were rolling her eyes, that made Laura like her all the more. But you glossed over the other thing.
What other thing?
When he said you get ahead on your back.
Laura said nothing.
You're normally quick to answer, Dr. Devane observed. Laura re-examined the drapes.
And I can't help but notice your sudden silence.
You're very perceptive, Laura said. Professional hazard.
Are you asking me whether I'm sleeping with the deputy?
Not a bad place to start.
Is it relevant?
Considering the comment that is the focal point of our discussion?
Dr. Devane tapped her pin against her front teeth.
I'd say it's relevant, yes.
It shouldn't be. I can sleep with whomever I damn well please.
Laura took a deep breath. Despite her best efforts, her voice had doubled in volume.
Laura, Laura. Dr. Devane made her voice quieter and more soothing in response.
Of course you can. When I say it's relevant, what I mean is that veracity plays a part here. The barbs people throw at us are sharpened by truth, even when it's something that has no place being barbed in the first place. Our beliefs, our appearance, who we sleep with. The ring of truth provides the necessary weight. It's how words can manage to cut us so deeply.
So what are you saying?
That if someone says something offensive, it hurts. But when we think it's true, that's when it rings in our ears. So, three questions. One, are you in a relationship with? She trailed off.
Franklin Stewart, Laura supplied.
Dr. Devane raised an eyebrow. I know, everyone calls him Frank.
Okay, Frank, are you in a relationship?
I've been here 2 months.
Is that a yes or a no?
Neither. It's just too soon to tell. We're seeing each other.
Two, in your own mind, are you leveraging your relationship with Frank to get ahead?
Laura crossed her arms and took another deep breath.
He's the one who called me yesterday, told me what was going on. It got me the article.
And three, do you feel bad about it?
Laura shook her head.
No.
Dr. Devane reached out and put a hand on Laura's knee.
You shouldn't. It's our social connections that let us prosper, and the lack of them that makes people wither. Fathers get jobs for sons. Old college friends make the right introductions. That's life. There's no shame in taking help from anyone, and your sex life has nothing to do with it.
So why are we talking about it?
Because this kind of thing does matter a great deal to a great many people.
But the only thing I'm concerned about is whether it matters to you.
It doesn't.
The doctor threw up her hands in mock surrender. Which means I don't think we need to explore it any further.
She paused.
But how's Frank?
Laura felt the corner of her mouth tug up, the beginning of a grin.
I thought we were done exploring.
My extreme perceptiveness is cluing me into the fact that it's a little strange you haven't mentioned him. I mean, relationships are the sort of thing most people talk about right away.
I'm not most people.
No, you definitely are not. Lara cocked her head, the second corner of her mouth pushing up now too. Another few seconds, and it would count as an actual smile.
Dr. Devane flushed and fidgeted with the bridge of her glasses.
I hope I didn't offend you. I actually meant that in a good way. Most of the people who visit me here in Hillsborough only come for one or two reasons.
My sessions with you are...
Well, I look forward to them, Laura. I like you. If it weren't for the fact that you're my patient, you and I might even have been friends. At the very least, why don't you start calling me Jasmine?
Jasmine, Laura said, trying it out.
Okay, if not your love life, how about your career? Can we talk about that?
Better than talking about my mother, I guess.
Laura had spent the first two sessions talking almost exclusively about her childhood, a topic that never seemed to wear out. Those years were like a fractal. No matter how closely she examined them, it was the same shit over and over again, allowing herself to embody a cliche. The patient with mommy issues had been almost as painful as the memories themselves.
Do a lot of people come in here and talk about their mothers?
Dr. Devane nodded. It's extremely common, yes.
Why is that?
You're doing it again.
What?
Asking questions about me, about therapy in general, about the modern state of psychological thinking. I'm supposed to be the one asking the questions.
Lara shrugged.
Professional hazard.
Dr. Devane nodded.
Point taken and a perfect segue. Can we talk about your career?
Sure,
Lara said.
Can we talk about Boston?
Nope, Laura said. It's obviously weighing on you. The very refusal to talk about it suggests...
Not today, okay?
You mentioned it in passing during our first session, and only then to explain your move back to Hillsborough. As far as I can see it, it upended your life, and we're not going to talk about it?
I don't pay you to bitch at me.
The words slipped out, and she regretted them almost instantly. Most people would have flushed at the comment, but the doctor remained perfectly calm.
Actually, you do, she said.
In fact, that might be one of my favorite descriptions of exactly what I do in here. Bitch at people. Shine a light on the things they'd rather not see. They sat together in silence for a while. Finally, Laura said,
I'm sorry I snapped.
I know you are.
But I just don't want to talk about it today.
Okay, let's make a deal. We skip it for today, and we talk about it next week.
Laura nodded.
So tell me about this story.
The dead girl?
I have a feeling that's what everyone's going to mean when they say the story, at least for a while.
Did you read my article?
Of course.
The majority of the 7,000 people in Hillsborough must have read that article.
Still, hearing it one-on-one gave her a little thrill.
Then you know what I know. Between you and me, that's about all the police know, too.
And do you think the editor, Mr. Herman, do you think Mr. Herman will take the story away from you?
He's giving me until this Sunday edition to come up with something.
That's effectively until tomorrow night.
He wants me to prove myself. Otherwise, he's going with Smythe.
And is that a fair offer?
Laura weighed this question.
I think he thinks it is. Finding something new in a murder investigation in about 30 hours, when the police have nothing, isn't exactly easy. On the other hand, that's the nature of the job, investigating facts and reporting them. Bassett didn't write the rules, he's just playing by them.
A brutal set of guidelines for a small-town paper, Dr. Devane said.
But not a small-town story.
How do you think losing the story would make you feel?
This time Laura didn't weigh her answer.
Bad. She said.
Dr. Devane shot her a grin.
Can you expand on that? Forgive my ignorance of the profession, but isn't it just one story? Won't there be others?
Two-part answer. Laura started ticking them off on her fingers.
One, it's the principle of losing the story. I may be biased, but yes, I'm the better reporter.
Dr. Devane cut in.
Then why would your boss take you off it?
He gave a reason that didn't sound like complete bullshit. Colin Smythe has lived here all his life and might have more success getting locals to open up to him. but I'm the better reporter and he knows it. In the end, Bass is just going with what he knows and who he knows. Bass Herman is old school, from a different era. It's the same everywhere, the good old boys network at play. So he lied to you. No, he doesn't see it like that. Which makes it worse. There are no villains in the world. Just millions of people with a very screwed up idea of what constitutes the right thing. Dr. Devane's brow furrowed. She said nothing. And two, Laura extended two fingers. Yes, losing this specific story would hurt more than losing another. Is it the girl? I don't know what you mean. Just that this story involves a dead girl, another one missing. It's in progress. Most reporting is on things that have already happened. Here, something you discover could be the key to finding Teresa Mitchum. Laura gave her a thin smile. It's not that. When I started in Boston, I covered some horrible things. Husbands killing wives. Wives killing husbands. Strangers killing strangers. Grown men beating children to death. I started out thinking the random killings were the worst. Then, at the end of my first month, I get assigned. I guess you'd call it a human outrage story. Human outrage, Dr. Devane repeated. It was a term of art in the Globe newsroom, like human interest, but not so warm and fuzzy. The opposite, in fact. Stories like that are one step above the police blotter. But it sells papers. People love to hate. I don't disagree, Dr. Devane said. But it's never Pulitzer material either. I was new, so I get assigned Howard Jenkins. Howard worked on Fleet Street as a partner at a law firm. And at the ripe old age of 49, he was diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver. Terminal, without intervention. Mrs. Jenkins, Susan, that was her name, stepped up and a liver donation was scheduled. It all goes great for Howard. He sheds that jaundiced yellow skin and goes back to playing squash and yachting and sleeping with his mistress. His mistress. Turns out that the cirrhosis was caused by hepatitis C, which he picked up sometime during his exploits around town. And Susan Jenkins found out. By that time, it was the least of her problems. You see, the operation didn't go so well for Susan. She got a liver infection. They controlled it with antibiotics, but it had already spread and damaged her kidneys. Fast forward to a year later, she weighs 90 pounds and spends 8 hours a day plugged into a dialysis machine. She needs a kidney fast. Luckily, her husband of 25 years is a perfect match. Dr. Devane said nothing. The day she asked for his help was the day he filed for divorce, Laura said, her voice flat as Kansas prairie. Played dirty, too. Took everything. She was dead in 6 months. The doctor crossed her arms, looked at the ground. There was a small outcry, of course, but he hadn't done anything illegal. No one could touch him, and I guarantee he didn't think it was wrong. How can you know? He'd never agree to an interview, but I caught up with him outside his building once. I didn't identify myself as a reporter, and he thought I'd just recognized him from one of the other newspaper articles. I asked him, "Did you learn anything from all this?" I was thinking his answer might acknowledge some of the terrible irony and injustice that had befallen his wife. Do you know what he said? Dr. Devane shook her head. He said, "Yeah, I learned something. Always wear a condom." The silence hung between them like a cloud. Laura took a breath. My idealism went the way of the dodo sometime that first year. The job isn't to change the world. Just report it. We're out of time, Dr. Devane said. Laura stood and noticed her hands had balled into fists. Each palm featured four white pinpricks surrounded by red, where the fingernails had dug into flesh. She opened the door and stepped into the hall. Laura, Jasmine Devane called after her. What you said, that there are no villains in the world. I don't agree. No? Why not? Because someone out there killed that little girl. Chapter 4. Her bedroom hadn't changed a lick in 11 years. Same brown carpet. Same rat pack poster. Same Minnie Mouse bedspread. Same faint odor of mildew always on the edge of being noticed. Home. Laura had been aghast to find it so untouched. On her return, a fine layer of dust coated everything, even the floor. No footprints. No one had so much as opened the door in years. She'd considered throwing it all out, starting over, but she didn't plan to stay long. What was the point of redecorating? So she'd washed and swept, and now 2 months later, she slept every night clutching Minnie Mouse. Once changed into a pair of old jeans, she slipped back down the hallway, boots in hand. The old farmhouse had foghorns for floor joists. As a teenager, Laura had mapped the various squeaks and pops until she could hop between the solid spots, like Indiana Jones at the end of The Last Crusade. She paused, listening outside the door of the master bedroom. Not a peep, which meant her mother was still asleep at 5:30 in the evening. More grateful than worried, Laura carried on down the stairs and out the front door. Big blue sky arched over her. The fields, summer green, stretched to the horizon. She slung a bag onto her back seat and took off down the dirt drive. The car, a 1969 Dodge Dart convertible in midnight blue, had 150,000 miles on its third engine and started on the first turn only half the time. The body was eaten through by rust in at least half a dozen spots. But the soft top still worked, and that was the only thing that mattered. Laura turned onto asphalt and hit the gas, felt the sweat on her brow evaporate as the wind played through her hair. Frank Sinatra singing the saccharine, New York, New York, carried her 3 miles south down Highway 57. A new song came on just as she hit the turn onto Highway 86, half a mile north of downtown. Brushes on a snare, opening Bobby Darin's version of Mac the Knife. She turned south. Highway 86 became Churton as it passed through downtown. Beyond the brick buildings at the town center, beautifully maintained Georgians and colonial revivals gave way to low-slung ranches and finally to corrugated warehouses along I-85. She got on and then off again a few miles later, turned into a neighborhood of double-wides, and stopped outside a yellow one with a pink flamingo mailbox and honked twice. A kid with a 35mm camera slung around his neck and a backpack in his hand came running out and hopped over the door without opening it. "Nice moves, Leon," Laura said and threw the car into gear. "Thanks, Miss Chambers." They turned back onto the interstate, back toward the Chambers farm. She glanced over at him. Leon Bowden wore his darkish hair buzzed short on the sides, with the longer top pushed into the center of his head, clad in a black t-shirt and black jeans. Feet stuffed into oversized combat boots, he appeared every inch the rebellious teenager. But that hadn't been Laura's experience. The few times they'd talked, he had been soft-spoken and thoughtful. Laura caught him staring at her as they pulled away. He'd been doing that a lot lately. "Getting a good look?" she asked. He snapped his head forward and started fiddling with the tuner, suddenly concerned about her choice in music. "You know, Leon, if you want to get a girl's attention, just staring and letting your mouth hang open isn't the best way." His mouth opened and then closed like a guppy on land. "I'm just teasing. You know that, right?" "Yes, Miss Chambers." She hoped he did. At the age of 17, Leon was responsible for more than half the photos in the Gazette. He was president of the Orange High Photography Club and covered all the local high school sports the people around here held dear. And he had a crush on her, of course, obvious in all the dopey Romeo looks he'd been shooting her way in the newsroom. She liked Leon. There was no substitute for manners in her experience. But ultimately, he was a reminder of how far she had fallen. She'd once teamed up with a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist. Now she had her very own high school student. "Miss Chambers? Call me Laura." "Laura." It rolled off his tongue about as smoothly as molasses. She could almost see his heart flutter. "Yes, Leon?" "It's great we finally get to work together." "Great, for sure. But when I get an assignment, usually Mr. Herman will, tell me a little bit more about it." "What does he usually tell you?" "Oh, I guess he tells me where I'm going,
what I'm supposed to take pictures of. You know, the basics.
Lara shot him a look.
Not that it matters, he added quickly. I'm just curious.
He crossed his arms and watched out his side of the dart as the buildings yielded to fields once again. He was probably trying to look cool, Lara thought. Face scrunched up, hair shifting in the wind. Of course he was trying too hard, but it wasn't bad for a 17-year-old.